favorite things about design is that it doesn't necessarily need to be complicated, first of all. Like, there are a lot of quips in design. Less is more is one of them that's really famous. That's sort of about this modernist approach of not decorating. But actually, if you really think about it, the simplest solution is often the best solution, right? It's like the most elegant. But as people, we don't really get a lot of credit for subtracting. Right. Like, if I come over and I empty out your closet, that's not going to be as fulfilling as if I say, mount a new TV to your wall. Right. Like, people want to add things. Or at work, if I say, like, well, I cut these seven things, that's what I did this year, it doesn't feel quite like, well, I started this new thing and I did that and I did that and I did that. So there's just a natural bias toward wanting to add. But if we're always adding, we're just kind of creating a mess, right? Like, we're creating more garbage. We're creating things on top of things. We're kind of just messing things up. But if we can think about design as like, well, what could I take away to make this work better? Like, as an example, let's say you, I don't know, I have always have trouble in my back door where everybody comes in the back door and there's like no place to put things. And, you know, we've got a desk back there where we do some work. And actually, the solution that we've come up with is to just empty everything out and have an empty space when you arrive so all that stuff can go in. So we never store anything on the way into the house. And that was like a years long process of what can we get rid of here to make this work? Or we tried buying things and that didn't work. And basically just emptying out the space worked. And that's a design solution, right? It's a simple one, but you can imagine how that could be applied elsewhere.
The song that kept in my head as I read the book was REM's Inside Out. What I choose not to do, I
Yeah.
can turn you inside out. And so that was kind of the soundtrack as I was reading this book.
That's
I
great.
love that.
I mean, it relates to constraints and values too,
Yeah.
right? Like, the things
Yeah.
you don't do are as much your values as the things you profess, you know?
Yeah.
And sometimes it's a luxury to not do things,
True.
right?
Yeah. So meaning that we have to be at a certain place or even a concept to choose not to do.
Yeah, absolutely. To be able to have that choice of what to engage in or not, like, requires you to be in a certain mind state. It requires you to be settled in many aspects. It's worth knowing that we're not always all of us at that same level at any given moment in time. And I mean, that's something, you know, when you brought up the emotions and designing with students earlier, that comes to mind is how do you give somebody a design process if it is about that subtraction that meets them where they are so that they can choose to engage in certain activities and to remove others?
You're pointing to pace and the idea that we get to slow down. And you have a quote in the book where pretending faster is better and that quick is efficient, but this actually leads to the long-term consequences. And so you do make a case for the slow parts.
We are obsessed with efficiency and productivity. And we're, especially in American culture, we are convinced that the two of these are linked. But the reality, right, is that when you come up with your best ideas, is likely when you're the most inefficient in the sense of the word, right? Like when I say efficiency, I'm referring to, like, you're at your desk and you're grinding away and you're making that daily progress that we might associate with productivity. But when our insights happen, right, when our brains have those aha moments, those are much more linked to times when we're actually hyper inefficient, when we are out wandering, when our senses are out of whack, when we notice something in our peripheral vision and it sparks an idea. And that can be just as reframing. Like, that is a really important design skill to be able to cultivate. This ability to get to an insight is just as important as the daily grind.
That the bit of an insight can be so much more productive
Yeah.
than, you know, a year of efficiency, right? So it can happen instantly. Now, it's not always guaranteed, but it that idea that efficiency equals productivity is off.
there's some examples too in the book of what you ask your students to do, and that's taking into consideration materials as a component. And so there's an exercise you talk about designing a chair, but the way that you offer that regarding materials, I thought was very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, in the same way that we talk about how our psyches kind of lead to what we create, what we work with or what we design also shapes our psyches and our ideas. So we call this assignment five chairs. And it was created also with a woman named Grace Hawthorne, who works at the D School, teaches there. And the idea is that we give different materials and the students have to make the same chair in different materials. So they draw one, they use sort of like a clay or something soft to make one, they use something hard like wood to make one, they use something sort of semi-malleable like metal or tinfoil, or, you know, and then we're just like letting the students go wild. And you see how the material kind of makes the chair, right? You're trying to make the same thing, but the material is kind of speaking back to you, and you don't know exactly how to make the same thing with the material, and you have to adjust, and then the design kind of changes. So, and you can think about that not just in terms of like physical materials. Carissa does a great assignment called the I Love Algorithms. That's about how do you do the same thing with different versions of machine learning, you know. So if you're going to do it this way, how does that change what your idea is? You do it that way, how does that change what your idea is? So it's just this constant back and forth between the things we use and make and how we think and do.
That material literacy that Scott's talking about is something that we all need more of, right? Because if you don't know that a certain type of material exists, you never think to use it, right? I could hammer together some wood, even though I'm not a master carpenter, but because I have a sense for how wood works, what type of weight it might be able to hold, and I know what it looks like when it falls over, right, or it burns down, I can consider like, oh, that this structure could be made out of wood. I use it. I'm literate in wood. But if you don't know how a classification algorithm works, not only do you not build with it, like you have no concept that it could ever be something that's created with. It's not in your vocabulary. And so one of our goals is to get students to be as literate in as many ways of making as many materials as possible. You don't have to be an expert in all of them, but you do need to have a sense for how they work and what they can do.
I'm really glad you brought this up, and this is a good segue, I think, to give our listeners a little bit of insight into who both of you were as people before you became invested in design as your career. And Carissa, I know you were a geologist for a while, and so I'm wondering how far back, teenager, young girl, this love for that was part of you.
You know, I think with, I was a geologist, and now I'm a designer. And I can't say that either one of those is what I grew up wanting to be. I always, and I still do want to go to space. Now that seems like it's more plausible. I'm just throwing that out there into the world. But I have always loved in geology, the part that I studied is called geomorphology, which are the processes that shape the landscape. Right. That is how our rivers carve. That is what our glaciers do. So really, they call them surficial processes, too. And I like it because it's this transitory piece of geology that's not like the deepest of Earth history, but it's much slower than our human day-to-day lives. Yet we are like directly causing changes in it. So it feels like this way that we as humans interact with the Earth. And I would be lying to say that like I could have planned any of this mm-hmm. way back when I was younger. I feel really lucky in my different career jumps. But that's a piece of me.
Do you have a favorite memory as a girl of perhaps being out in nature or looking at the land or the wood and thinking, wow, This really is amazing part of life.
Yes, there was this patch of woods behind the house where I grew up. I grew up in Massachusetts. And in wintertime, I would walk out there just wander by myself, right? And I absolutely love snow for its, muffling capacity on not just sound, but also like it muffles your mind and your thoughts too. And like it changes, it's like it turns on a sixth sense of awareness. And I can feel myself, I know exactly where I was in this piece of woods, and there were white birch trees around me, and like the white birch in the snow is tied one to one. And I remember just feeling more in tune than ever with that place. I felt like the only person, you know, I'm only like probably 50 yards from a home, you know, but I just felt so connected.
Yeah, I felt that. Thank you for taking us there. And and that permeates your book too, because there's the part too that says, what if our job were to help other people know that they're beautiful, or something like that. And so the way you speak about the silence in the snow and the sixth sense kind of evokes that. Yeah. Scott, how about you? Any origin stories, as it were, from a kid as a thread to what you're doing now?
Yeah, I think I, as a kid, I just loved making things up, you know, whether that was like play acting or drawing or whatever. And I had this habit when I was drawing of adding sound effects to the drawings, you know, like if somebody was skiing, I'm drawing, I'm like, you know, if somebody's, I don't know, like jumping into water, I'm making splash sounds, you know? And I think then when I went to film school at UCLA and worked in the film industry for a while, and it was there where I realized, oh man, this is a group of people, meaning like the instructors and the other students at film school, who take make-believe really seriously. You know, I would come in with a diet, like I did a film about a kid who wanted to be different. And so he was thinking about like, you know, how he could change his body. Like, was he going to cut off a toe, or would he like shave his head? Or he just wanted to look different because he felt different. And it was such a wild idea for me, and almost like frightening, you know, like I was like, I don't know why I'm like so interested in this. And everyone just critiqued it as if it was like the most normal idea, and just like, well, here's how you could do that, and here's what you might want to think about for people watching it. And, you know, it was just these wild ideas taken very seriously, because the things that we imagine sort of also create these narratives for us, right? They are something to be taken seriously. So that was the first time I was in a place where I was like, wow, make-believe is something that is worth paying attention to.
I'm speaking with Carissa Carter and Scott Dorley, co-authors of Assembling Tomorrow. If you want to learn more about their work, go to dschool.stanford.edu/books, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Travis Glenn Sabera. You're listening to New Dimensions. I wanted to share a bit. In my youth, I thought I wanted to be a cartographer. And so I went to college with the intention of studying maps and map making. And so I was very excited. In the book as well, you spend quite a bit of time on maps, what they do, what they don't do, and how to be in the world that way. And so I'm wondering if we could hear a little bit more about the importance of maps in design.
Man, how long do we have? I absolutely love talking about maps. I think we could approach this from so many angles, but how about this? One is, we can use maps to both make sense of information as well as to share information with others. And if we think about maps as a tool for making sense of information, let's expand our view of what a map is from not just a geographic map of a landscape or a political area, but instead to include different frameworks, like a simple continuum from then to now, or you might be familiar with a Venn diagram, and you can look at overlapping relationships. Those types of maps, which are, you know, utilize a spatial dimension and the visual in some way, are really useful for sorting through ideas and for helping you to make sense of what you're looking at, to find some sort of insight. We were talking about insights before. I, you know, for in my own personal work, I find that using those types of mapping structures is like putting a new lens on my work, and you never know when a new idea is going to pop out.
It's almost a synonym, but as maps are metaphors as well. And so you spend quite a bit of time, too, talking about the importance of the metaphor we choose as influencing what we might come up with.
Yeah, and actually, especially in this time, shifting around what metaphor you're using to describe things. Because if you look at an argument between two people, often it's a disagreement about the mental model of what we're talking about. You know, so one person might see, you know, an argument about a parking spot as, you know, an existential crisis because no one's kind of respecting what I want to be doing in my life. Another person might just see it as a functional thing where they just need to get to the grocery store. So you have this one mental model that's like how people treat each other in the world, and another that's like just kind of how do we move through space? And the argument then unfolds around these differences of how you imagine what is. And so the usefulness that we found is that if you shift metaphors in whatever it is you're doing, but particularly when we're thinking about runaway design and these technologies, to look at it from different ways. Because when you think about AI, you know, that's been called sort of like nuclear energy, and it's an existential crisis, and we need to have treaties. And, you know, that's one way of looking at it. But it hides the fact that, well, also other people say it's a calculator for words. And, you know, that means it's a very useful tool, and it's totally controllable. And how great is this? And neither one is right or wrong. They're just revealing different things about the technology or whatever it is we're dealing with. So shifting how you reveal, shifting the metaphor is really important.
So it may make sense even before engaging in a conversation. You know, Charles Taylor, the Canadian philosopher, has the idea of entre nous, which means that the space and the context for the interaction and the dialogue is so important. And so even before talking about what we're thinking to talk about is to kind of reveal to whomever we're speaking with what framework we're holding as primary.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think you can then get to the next step, right? Like if we're not acknowledging that we're talking about things in a different way, that we have different mental models, we're never actually even close to connecting on it because we're just trying to figure out and argue about how we're thinking about it versus saying like, hey, if we thought about it like this, where would that take us?
That's something that anybody can do too, right? And we have our students try on different metaphors on top of their work, right? So you could say, okay, you have an idea for a new way of communicating with people you don't know across the other side of the world. All right, like you're in the really early stages. If that idea were a river, tell me about the different parts. What would be the main fast flow through it? What would we be eroding if we brought that into the world along the side? What other elements might be floating within it? If that same idea was a solar system, what would the sun be? Right? Like, what is that thing that everything's orbiting around? It helps you clarify what you're prioritizing or express, you know, what might be that comet that comes in and throws everything out of whack, right? So those metaphors that Scott's talking about can help us bring to light some of the things that usually remain invisible or unseen when we're talking about our ideas.
As Scott brought up film, I thought, does this apply that, in the film industry, Dan Harmon, so many episodes of Community took a familiar trope of film, an action, a Western, an anime, a claymation. And so they put the same characters in different genres to see what would come out.
I love that idea. That gets into the materials and shifting your materials as well. Because what you do and how you do it, particularly how you do it, changes the meaning of it. It changes what you notice. And I think that's the main thing, is that especially in this era of runaway design, when things feel like they're moving so fast, if you're not working in a certain way to find opportunities, they just go by. You know, they're really all in this mess. There are a bunch of opportunities hiding in this mess. And how can we shift our frame so that we can notice the things that are worth noticing and worth following?
Do you have some kind of activity or invitation we could give our listeners just to to practice this out as they're out and about in the world?
One of my favorites is called a derive or a derive. It's a French word, which comes from the psychogeography movement. Guy Debord is one of the originators or practicers of this movement. And what they did, and or what you can do on a derive, is you can go outside and you can let the journey take you. Derive means drift, so we want you to drift. So set your watch for 20 minutes. No other devices allowed, nothing else allowed. And you could tell yourself, okay, I'm going to follow a color. So I see that blue right there on the side of the house, and I'm going to walk over to it. And then once you get there, like, you're just noticing the next blue in your peripheral vision, which is in the, you know, paint on that car that is across the street, and I'm going to walk over to it. And you just allow that journey to take you. Don't be worried too much about the strictness of sticking with your color or whatnot. Absolutely, you'll be blown away. We send students on these derives and they come back changed people. Some people follow acceleration or shadows or sounds that they heard or textures. And they just have this new appreciation for a place that they thought they knew.
Yeah, that's that. We work with a woman who does PR for books, and she did one, a book, with a guy who walked every single street in New York. Every single street. And he found that most people have never walked on the block in New York behind their apartment, right? So like, you live one block away from something, but because you're generally going like north-south to get to the subway station, you never go around the other side. And so all these people just imagine like they had never seen 20 feet away from where they lived, right? So there's so much to see out there, but you have to force yourself to see it in a different way.
I love these invitations. And the final part of the book, you bring up the concept of design for healing. A call to action is a design for healing. And I'm just wondering what we can leave our listeners today with expanding this idea.
Yeah, I think if we go back to that quote I mentioned earlier from Gregory Bateson, that the most of the problems in the world are a function of the difference between how nature works and how people think. And there's another story in the book that's about the Yangtze River in China, which moves east-west and bisects China north and south. And north they grow wheat and south they grow rice. And there are very different cultures because of that, right? Wheat is easier to grow on your own. Rice takes a lot of coordination to move water through the paddies. And so in the south, measured by patents, divorce rates, psychological studies. In the South, it's much more collaborative. In the North, it's much more breakthrough. And if you think of that in terms of creativity, we tend to think of creativity, we're in Silicon Valley, right? We're at Stanford. It's about disruption and breakthrough and new things and what can we do next? And that's really important. There are a lot of things that we need to invent. There are a lot of things that we need to transcend. But there's another way of looking at creativity as well, which is, what needs connecting? What do we need to bring together? What things here are not working with each other in the way that they should? How can we bring things things together so that we can all live in harmony? And there's a big movement right now around nature-based solutions for climate problems. So that's like plant more trees rather than, you know, invent a new technology that's going to capture carbon, you know, through balloons in the atmosphere or whatever. So it's these simple things that bring harmony rather than these things that disrupt and transcend and go beyond. Not to say that those aren't needed, but we need more of that sort of harmony healing, I think.
And is this term you've used, designed for healing, is that gaining traction? Is that a way to speak about it, that we can go to conferences or other design schools and they may be speaking of it this way?
I think Scott coined that term in this book, and it's one that I think resonates. It's built on this premise, like he's saying, that's very simple. What we make will, even if it's working properly, break something, disrupt someone, displace somebody's job. And the more that we can be aware of that and shepherd what we're creating forward, the better outcomes for all of us.
I've been speaking with Carissa Carter and Scott Dorley, co-authors of Assembling Tomorrow. If you want to learn more about their work, go to dschool.stanford.edu/books. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Travis Glenn Sabara. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3840.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over 4 decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
This is Bird Note. A bird's bill is perhaps one of nature's most incredible multi-tools. Good for preening feathers, self-defense, scratching, displaying, building a nest, and turning eggs. The bill of each bird species is perfectly adapted to meet the needs of that species. Whether it's probing for worms, cracking open seeds, or tearing into fresh meat. And a bird's bill must do things that other animals accomplish with paws or other appendages. In a marsh or wet meadow, you might see a great blue heron impale a fish with its massive spearhead of a bill. Or perhaps you'll spot a mallard using its spatula-like bill to sift tiny animals and plants out of the water. The Wilson snipe uses its long, slender bill to probe the dirt for earthworms, while a peregrine falcon uses its sharp, hooked beak to tear apart its prey. Call it a beak or call it a bill. For each and every bird, it tells a story. Next time you go birding, see what a bird's beak can tell you. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Did you know BirdNote delivers the wonder and joy of birds directly to your inbox? Sign up for our newsletter at birdnote.org to get a weekly preview of our shows, stories, photos, and more.
Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started. So I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians, the music library, acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs. Interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures. Public relations. Postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.